Hello, and welcome to Pinecone Podcast, where we have conversations about issues that are important to you, like faith and family, religion and relationships, Christianity and the church, and a whole lot more. So grab a cup of coffee or your favorite drink, sit back, relax, and enjoy Art, Wes, and Lacey as they have a conversation on Evergreen's Pinecone Podcast. So hello, this is Art. Welcome to those who are listening, and welcome this morning. We're in the morning time to Wes and Lacey. How are you guys doing?
Very well.
A little bit of a slow reaction there. Coffee not kicked in?
No, I was trying to allow the lady to go first.
That was very sweet of you.
However, the lady took too long.
I was actually thinking you might go first, but my tea is kicking in, so that's good.
Okay.
I'll do coffee.
Well, a few podcasts back, Wes and Lacey, you all talked about a part of a book by Jerry Scazzaro, I think I said her name right, called The Emotionally Healthy Woman. And I didn't want Wes to have all the, all the right to be the emotionally healthy woman. I don't want him and Lacey to be the only two on this podcast. So we're going to talk about it again today. Well, I opened that up for you.
But a different chapter.
Yes. So The Emotionally Healthy Woman, it's subtitled, eight things you have to quit to change your life. And in fact, the book was previously titled I Quit. And I think one of the I quits that you all talked about was, help me out, quit being afraid of what others think, right?
Yes.
And today we're going to talk about quit over functioning. And our sort of starting definition, maybe, quit over functioning. Quit doing for others what they can do for themselves or what they should do for themselves. And I want us to start off this time with Lacey. Could you just give us a little brief, however brief you want to be, like maybe a little background of where Jerry was coming from when she wrote this chapter on quit over functioning?
Yes, so definitely an awesome definition. Quit doing for others what they can and should do for themselves. We talked a little bit about her story when we talked about stop fearing what other people think. And I think that this kind of continues to come out of that for sure. And she was at a point where she realized that she was over-functioning in the home, which was allowing her husband to under-function in the home. And whenever there is an over-functioner, you can almost always be sure that there is an under-functioner. And so her husband, let me back up. She was doing all the cooking, the cleaning, the bills, the taking care of the academics for their kids, the parenting, and she was just getting exhausted. And what she says is her husband, it's not like he was lazy in some way. She over-functioned for him in home, and he was able to over-function then in work. So he was always at work, pouring everything that he had into work, which meant there were probably people at his work, which he is a pastor in New York City, that were under-functioning. And so she just got to this point, this breaking point, where she realized, like, I just can't keep doing this. And so that's kind of where we're at as she starts to explain her story. Do you guys have anything you want to add to that?
Wes?
Not really. That sounds okay. Like what I remember.
Okay. Yeah. And so I just wanted to be clear that I think some people hear over functioners and you may not want to admit that in your life because it would mean that you would have to call somebody else out in their under functioning. And so just taking the time to recognize that when you call somebody else out, you're not necessarily calling them lazy or calling them immature. You're recognizing in your own life the things that may need to change so that they're a healthy balance kind of comes back to the relationship.
So I was thinking about some other things she added. By the way, you can listen to this chapter for free on Peter Scazzaro's podcast. So if you just go to his podcast and listen to Overfunctioning, he actually did two podcasts where he just actually played the recording from the book. So that's one nice thing. And it's Jerry who reads it. So as I think about this, he was not helping out at home, but one of the ways he was probably overfunctioning at church is like he wouldn't take the vacation that he needed. And one of the things that their family would kind of take some time at the ocean or at a home, I forget where it was. And she wouldn't actually do that because he wanted her to be there even though he was working. And so again, he's overfunctioning at church, but that in part relied on her being overfunctioning in the home in order mm-hmm. to enable him to be able to overfunction at the church.
Right.
So by not taking his vacation and so on, not taking a break.
Right. Right. And that was even, I think that even happened like in evenings and things like that, where, you know, he relied on her to make sure the kids had dinner and get them to bed and things like that so that he could stay late. He wasn't even like setting boundaries with hours of time that he was spending at work.
Right. She probably did things for him too. Mm-hmm. Based on that. What about, do you remember is this in that chapter where they talk about the Sunday dinner? Almost drowned?
No, this is not that chapter.
Oh, okay. But it fits well.
Make people want to read the book. Yeah.
That's right. I mean, no, that was a real revealing moment for them because they refused to set emotional boundaries. You know, she didn't agree with what he was doing. She wanted him to say no, but she tried to make everything right. And their kid ends up almost drowning. Right.
Right. Right.
I'm trying to go ahead.
I don't remember it correctly. This is the chapter, and this was really telling for me, where she talks about how he had invited two really well-known Christian speakers to the house. And she cleaned the house and she cooked all this stuff from scratch and she just made sure everything was perfect. And they were sitting down to dinner and one of the speakers just wasn't hungry. And so he pushed the plate away. I was like, oh no, thank you. I'm just really not hungry. And it was like, she just like, she couldn't be present for the rest of the time there because she was so resentful of the way that he just kind of pushed that away. But that was really in her own heart. It wasn't anything that was in that speaker's heart. Like, it's not like he was trying to reject her meal or whatever. And I think that leads really well into what the five kind of signs, the consequences of overfunctioning. And to me, these are the signs you should be looking for to see whether or not you are overfunctioning.
Well, before we go into that, I just want to make clear that Lacey did not do that. She did not push away the meal. When I made lasagna for the first time last night. And I didn't do it right. I didn't read. I underfunctioned by not reading the directions on the noodles. The rest of the lasagna turned out right. It's just the noodles weren't cooked. But an hour and 20 minutes later, they
it
were
was
cooked.
Fantastic. Yeah.
And she actually, she's lying. But
it was really good.
So she ate the lasagna. So she was
no wonder she was hungry by then.
Right. Hour 20.
So starve people to death. That's the key.
It was very good. He did a good job, but he did.
I think another thing to point out too, Lacey, you said you were talking about calling someone out that's under functioning. And I mean, in this story, and probably often when we see the overfunctioner, both of them actually were overfunctioners, so to speak. It's just in different places. So, so when she called him out, like you said, he wasn't lazy. He actually was overfunctioning as well.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's just, you can see from the relationship that there was not a healthy balance there. And I feel like that really is the key. In fact, one of the consequences of overfunctioning is that you perpetuate immaturity. And so that doesn't mean that you're immature in all the areas of the life of your life, or that underfunctioner is immature in all the areas of his or her life. But it does mean that in particular areas, they're not able to mature as much as they could if they were given the chance to actually grow in that area. So I'm just going to name off the 5 consequences of overfunctioning, and then we can run through them if you guys have any thoughts on them. And this is sort of my checklist. Are these things happening in my life? If they are, I'm probably overfunctioning. The first one is it breeds resentment. We saw that in the story of where she prepared for the speakers to come, and the guy wasn't hungry. Perpetuates immaturity in others, and maybe even in ourselves. Prevents us from focusing on our life's calling, and erodes our spiritual life. Sorry, there's 4. I lied. Maybe lying is one.
Destroys community is the 5th.
Oh, destroys community. I apologize. There was 5. Thank you. You saved me. So we talked about breeds resentment a little bit. If you notice that there's some resentment building up in your life, it's really a good time to ask yourself, why am I so resentful? And it may bring out other things, not just overfunctioning.
Sure. Always a good question.
Yeah.
What's going on under the hood?
Yeah. Well, and I think that's something in a lot of our conversations, just stopping to ask yourself, why am I feeling this way? Really helps you to evaluate what's really going on. And so this is just one of those opportunities. Perpetuates immaturity. And I liked the example she uses in the book of Moses and Jethro. Do you guys remember that?
Oh, yes, definitely. It's a great example.
Yes. So, you summarize it?
Yeah, sure. So Moses takes charge to do basically listen to every single case that comes up amongst the tens of thousands of the people of Israel. And Jethro comes and watches him and says, what you're doing is not good. You're going to wear yourself out. You're going to wear the people out. So Moses was overfunctioning when there was plenty of people who could and should hear those cases, who could be leaders. He said, let them hear the cases. If they have difficulties, let it kind of establish a hierarchy where they can bring it to another person. And then finally to you. You deal with the hardest cases. So in other words, focus on that which belongs to you, and then let other people do the things that can that belong to them. So I think I think the Jethro example is a great Jethro and Moses example. Exodus 18, I think, is a wonderful example of overfunctioning and how leaders can overfunction. Those who are kind of in a position of responsibility already can tend to take more responsibility, kind of amplify mm-hmm. that over everything. That's kind of a unique temptation to leaders.
Yeah, and I like the way what she said in the book was Moses had actually become an obstacle to his people's maturity. And so that's kind of when you're another question, like when you are realizing that there are immaturity for me as a mom, there are, you know, things that I might see in my kids, like, okay, here's an area I really want my child to mature in. Am I being an obstacle for them to mature by doing too much? What could they be doing for themselves in the situation that they should be doing for themselves in the situation?
Right.
So that's just another. Do you guys have any examples from your?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, awesome.
The fact. Well, and what makes that hard is not just our own. It is the reason is that when they can't, they feel they can't do something that they should or could, is that they often show that they're feeling pain. And so that's where you have to kind of check yourself and see, you know, is this overfunctioning is often the result of us not just like not wanting to just do things in the abstract for others, but when they have a pain in doing something, wanting to relieve that pain. So you have to increase your threshold for other people's pain, recognizing that pain is not bad. It's not in and of itself a totally negative thing. It's actually the context for growth a lot of times. And so let me make it very concrete. So my youngest daughter was basically saying, and this was a couple of years ago. I mean, she was 5 years old. And she was like, I can't do the toast. I can't put the bread in there and push it down. And I said, I think you can. And she kind of fell apart. And she was like, I don't think I can. But I knew that she could.
Right.
And so it was not easy for me to work past, you know, her crying, her, the things that she was experiencing there and the pain that she was showing by her tears and wrath and anger and all that frustration. So, but I held to my guns there and I said, no, I'm not going to do this for you. You can do it.
Yeah.
And so she did eventually do it. But I had to say, I'm going to tolerate the pain that she's expressing in order to allow her to do that. But then after she did it, this is the other thing is I said to her, see, you did it and you can do more than you think you can. And that's the thing is that when we take charge and do things for other people that they could do for themselves, then we take away their own sense of agency and their own strength and abilities that God has given them. We diminish that sense. So I always try to point those things out when they actually do things that they didn't think they can do, which is innumerable things. And that's true for adults too. Like we have all sorts of illegitimate fears and discomforts with things that we can easily do, like swimming in 50 degree water. It's really okay. just something I did last week. It was actually quite refreshing, but there was definitely like, do I really want to do this? But I love swimming in Lake Michigan. So I did. Now I feel better about it, you know? So, but the point is that they can feel better about the things that they give. I mean, there's a wrong sense of thinking that you can do more than you can. Like, and we have all sorts of false guilt about things that we can't do. The idea that we should never make mistakes, that we should be able to make everybody happy and blah, blah, blah. But there's also sort of like an illegitimate feeling of weakness as if we can't do the things that we actually could. So, so like, I can't cook dinner for myself. Well, you actually could. You could read the directions and you could figure it out. And sometimes even if you don't read the directions, then you learn from that mistake and you realize how to do it better next time.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's actually a maturity in ourselves that's missing if we can't sit with someone through their pain as they're learning and growing. She kind of mentions that at the end of the chapter, you know, we really need to work on our own maturity of being able to wait and allow the process to work. So lots of talk of maturity and immaturity and ways that we can grow, which I love.
I think it's so lack of maturity, but it's also some of what we're talking about as the overfunctioner is not necessarily, could not necessarily be viewed as a bad thing. Just in your example, Wes, with the toaster, as a parent, you might want to step in and keep your child from feeling that pain. You might want to stop her from feeling the tears or do things for your child. When she was 2 years old, she couldn't reach the toaster. So it would have been a good thing for you to reach the toast, or, you know, do the toast for her. So I think the overfunctioner can think, I'm actually doing a good thing.
Oh, sure.
And get lost in that. And when you go back, she gives in the book like an overfunctioning inventory, and it's like a list of questions that you ask yourself if I'm an overfunctioner. And some of them actually can kind of be quite positive. The very first one, I generally know the right way to do things. I mean, you could view that as a good thing, but and then some of the others in here, you know, I often do what is asked of me, just like when we were talking about in Jerry and Pete's story, that he was doing things at the church where people were asking of him, that, you know, he could see that as a good thing. So I think that it is a lack of maturity, but I just wanted to point out that sometimes overfunctioning cannot be viewed as a negative if you're not careful. Like even Moses probably thought it was good that he sat and listened to everybody's case and that they brought it all to him. He was doing God's work. He was God's man. He probably thought he was doing a good thing. But as Lacey, right, like he was pointing, the whole point of what you were pointing out, he was keeping the people from learning how to be able to listen to cases and judge, you know, I don't know if you judge, but determine what they needed. So
let me read a quote. This is from Harrington, Creech, and Taylor in the book, The Leader's Journey, that fits in right with what you're saying. They said, everyone knows that chronic underfunctioners need to change. In contrast, if we overfunction, we may truly believe that God is on our side. So that's
right. Which is a fantastic quote. And it brings us to the point, really, overfunctioners will not change until, I'm sorry, underfunctioners will not change until overfunctioners take that first step, because there's so much benefit to continue underfunctioning that really the pain is usually felt on the side of the overfunctioner. Because you get to that breaking point. And so being willing to take that first step and make the change is really what changes the whole dynamic of the relationship and allows it to start moving toward a more healthy state of being.
I'm not sure I would want to make it quite as absolute as that, as if, you know, it can never happen.
Sure.
So, you know, I think that we need to be cautious, as if the underfunctioner is totally dependent on the overfunctioner. I don't think you would mean to say it that way. But there is a truth, and kind of how I might say it is that the overfunctioner is kind of the one who takes initiative. So that they often are the ones who can change more readily, like just like Jerry Scazzaro did. Like she realized she was overfunctioning, and so she saw, this is going to help if I don't do these things that I've been doing, if I quit. And so she was able to do that because she was the one who was proactive in taking the initiative, whereas the underfunctioner is not as proactive. But I would say that sometimes underfunctioners realize like it's not a healthy way of living, and they see their need to take things under control. And that may be a challenge, and maybe even feel some resentment towards the overfunctioner.
Right. The quote that I'm actually kind of referring to is, she says, if an underfunctioner is going to take responsibility, we who overfunction must cease from saving, fixing, or advising. Growing up in any area of life is challenging. Few underfunctioners will make the first move because the benefits they receive are too satisfying, at least in the short term. So yeah, that's kind of, I think, what we're both getting at.
Yeah, and she said that specifically in the book. You know, remember, she was like with her kid's soccer game, and she decided, well, if he doesn't take them to the soccer game, then they just won't go. or she was like, if he doesn't prepare the room for the guest room in their house, then they just won't have an overnight guest. So she had to kind of, in a way, I don't know, draw a line in the sand, I guess you would say, and just say, it's just not going to happen. She had to take that attitude, but I don't think that she really meant it like in that way. I think she ultimately kind of knew those things would happen, just wasn't going to be her that did them.
But you got to be willing to let people fail.
Right.
That's the thing. And, you know, sometimes we look at failure as if it's the ultimate evil. When it's like, if you actually look back on your life, failure is what has enabled you to learn the most. And so to keep other people from that, and again, I'm not saying that you would do that in every instance.
Right.
But, you know, it takes some wisdom. But I think just to go in and say, people do fail. Our kids will fail. They will make mistakes. They will do things that we wouldn't want them to do. And that is how they will learn. And we can be okay with that on one level.
Right. And we know that that is also how God has operates. You know, he shouts to us in our pain. I think it's a C.S. Lewis quote. Where, you know, God, I'm going to butcher this quote, but basically whispers to us in the joys of our life, but he shouts to us in our pain. And just recognizing, like, pain is what helps us recognize the need for change or for growth or for whatever. And so when we overfunction for someone and don't allow that pain in their lives, that's does not allow for growth or for change.
Yeah. And also especially I think in terms of our kids, so for example, if they need money and, you know, and we don't give it to them, and or they want money and they don't want to work, if we kind of press upon them are like, you need to get a job, you need to be working, blah blah blah, then a lot of times we become the issue instead of their lack of money. We become the focus, which readily happens. But if we just say, okay, well, thanks for letting me know, as I often say to my kid, thanks for letting me know that that's your situation. Appreciate you sharing. Then let them kind of deal with it, figure it out. I've been surprised as I've kind of tried to engage in that, how often they kind of let, oh, okay, well, I guess I got to do something. And so,
right. Yeah. Which is a neat way to talk about the next consequence of our overfunctioning, which it prevents us from focusing on our life's calling. She in the book specifically talked about a job that she was interested in, but I actually wanted to reference 7 Habits of Highly Effective People again. And he talks about mission statements and how important mission statements are. And I think spending some time in your quiet time with God, just asking, like, what's the calling that you've placed on my life? And kind of writing out a mission statement for what you really feel like God is calling you to do. What are the things that I value that are important to me? And then allowing your decisions to be guided by that mission statement.
Yeah, so that means saying no to some things and yes to others. And so some of those things, so you have to ask, do I need to do this for other people? You know, can they do it on their own so that I can focus on what's most important, what God is calling me to do. And that's the first habit, you know, is focus on your area of responsibility. And Cloud and Townsend in their book on how people grow, put it in the context of God giving us responsibility over creation, but noticing those things that are our responsibility and those things that God hasn't given us as our responsibility. And he wants us to focus on those.
Yeah. And I do really recommend, if this is something you're interested in learning more about, getting this book. She has a list of questions that we won't go through now. She just says, do you routinely make time to ask questions, these certain questions to yourself. And it's just a really neat way to evaluate if you are sticking to your life's calling. The one question that I found really interesting was, what will I do with my time when I stop overfunctioning? And I think that's a really hard question for overfunctioners to answer, because the answer might be like, relax. And that's a really difficult thing for someone who is a constant overfunctioner to do.
Well, and you get a payoff from it.
So, yeah.
And well, and one of the things I want to kind of take off from this and just say, the idea of overfunctioning comes up in psychology. It's kind of, it's not a biblical term, even though I think the concept is present in the scriptures, but it comes from family systems therapy and kind of the observation of how families function. Then it can be applied out into wider spheres, such as, you know, the state, the workplace, the church. And one of the things I would say is Jerry Scazzaro takes a more negative view of overfunctioning than you will find in the psychological literature. Generally, it's not viewed as a moral category, but more as just a response to anxiety that can be okay, or that can be problematic. And so one of the things I would say is that overfunctioning and underfunctioning are not necessarily bad things. They have their benefits, namely that they get you involved in people's lives. So overfunctioning is a way of getting involved, and underfunctioning is a way of getting other people involved in your life. And so and sometimes you can do these things rather deliberately, as ways of getting people involved in your life. I think the key thing is to know that to be aware that you're doing it. And to see that what it does is it does reduce anxiety as you get people involved in your life. So if you start overfunctioning, you know, you feel better. I need to do something to, you know, because I'm struggling, and it actually works. And so if you're aware of that, then I think it can be okay. The problem is when it becomes such a deeply ingrained automatic pattern that inhibits growth, that it keeps you from focusing on things, or it harms the relationship. So I mean, that's kind of how it would be seen a little bit more in the psychological literature. So I would probably maybe take a halfway point between her and the psychological literature myself, just to say we can look at these things with a little bit more with a little bit less intensity than what she does. Similar to like distancing and conflict as other responses to anxiety and relationship, those things are not necessarily bad. Sometimes people, there are certain people who think that conflict is bad, you know, and distance is good. I don't think that's true. It's good to be able to fight things out, you know, those that can help us both calm ourselves and figure out new solutions to problems. Distancing can be good because it allows us time to cool down. But again, if it becomes a problem and a pattern where we no longer are able to really interact as persons or share all our ideas, and we too quickly move to those things, then it becomes a problem. So anyways, I'd like to leave a little bit more room for maybe a less intense view of this than you'll find in Jerry Scazzaro's book. I mean, it's pretty like, you shall not overfunction. I mean, it's... And so I encourage you to listen to the chapter. It's good. It's forceful. I mean, it's powerful. She's a force.
Yeah. And I think that they were both coming from such an extreme place in the relationship that's why she's so passionate about it. It's like, don't ever get to this place. Like, it's just a really unhealthy place to be. But yeah, I like that you're taking more of a middle of the ground, stance on it. Her next consequence is overfunctioning erodes your spiritual life. And she talks about Martha and Mary. And she says, Martha was such an overfunctioner that she started telling Jesus what to do. And I thought that that was really interesting because she's like, you need to tell my sister to stop just sitting there and help me. And so I just think that's a, Jerry says, when we cross the line and put ourselves in charge of running God's world for him, we enter into dangerous territory, into the very rebellion of our ancestors, Adam and Eve. And that's very true. When we start over-functioning for God, that's a big problem.
That's true. But I still think, I also agree with what Wes said of taking the extremes, you know, in that example. I don't think, did Jesus say, so Martha, quit doing what you're doing? He just said that she had her mind on the wrong things, but that didn't mean that she should just completely stop preparing what she was doing. It was just,
right.
It was just her concern. Everybody else should have the same concerns that I have. You know what I mean?
Right. But I think he also kind of challenged her to reevaluate her priorities. Like, okay, you're doing this, which isn't necessarily bad, but you could be choosing what Mary's choosing, and what she's chosen is better. So I think in saying that, he just was saying, you're so worried about this that you're missing the point. You're missing what is the most important thing. And so when we start over functioning, we can tend to miss what is most important. And she talks about specifically, she knows she's over functioning when she doesn't have time for God, when she doesn't have time to sit down and talk to God on a daily basis, and when she doesn't have time for a Sabbath. And she talks about Sabbathing really changing her perspective and the relief that she feels in the evening when she symbolically shuts off the lights and says, okay, God, like I'm shutting my phone down. I'm shutting my computer down. You're taking care of the world for the next 24 hours, which is kind of a funny thing to say to God because he's always taking care of the world, but it's a relief for her and just an opportunity for her to lay down her pride in thinking that she can, that the world will fall apart without her.
Right. And I think through all this, it's the overfunctioner needs to take the responsibility to make those changes themselves. You know, a couple of things that she said, overfunctioning leaks out in sarcasm and complaining. I think the overfunctioner can complain, well, you know, they never do anything. They never help me. And my kids never help me, or my spouse never helps me. Or if you're at work, you know, the employees never do anything or never work. When in reality, it's just that you're stepping in and doing it yourself and not allowing them the opportunity to do it. So it comes out as what then as a result, I, the overfunctioner, complain when really it's really my fault. So
right. That resentment kind of comes out, that resentment of I shouldn't have to do this. But in reality, if it's really difficult for an overfunctioner to let go of those things because it a lot of times becomes their identity. It becomes where they find their value. I find my value in doing all of these things for other people and being indispensable. And so it is difficult a lot of times for overfunctioners to lay that down and say, I'm not really needed as much as I think I am. Yeah, and I think that's why moms struggle with it a lot.
Well, and I think that the lure of that, I've seen that when in a situation where there's kind of a positive overfunctioning, in other words, you have to do, it's not they can and should do for themselves, but like, so for example, when my wife is sick or when I've been there by myself with another child who's sick and just that all the things you have to do for them, you know, there's a reward there that you feel like you're needed. You feel like you're doing something meaningful to really help someone. And I've realized, like, you know, just seeing that in glimpses, you know, a day or 2 days at a time, I would just be like, you know, if this continued over the years, then if that changed, that would be really hard to let go, because there is a big payoff in caring for others. And sometimes in a good way, like actually doing what we need to do for others. So it's easy to extend that out and do more and more that we don't need to do.
Right.
Because there's a payoff. Right.
And it becomes over-functionary and not even realize it.
Right. Yeah. And it's a really sticky place, I think, for women specifically, especially women who have been stay-at-home moms or just moms in general, because you are doing a lot for this other person. And they slowly, instead of like that reward continuing to be there, they slowly become more and more independent of you, more and more. Well, they need you less and less. And so it's really, really important for women to understand that they have value outside of caring for other people. Really important for them to find their value in who Jesus says that they are, and not in their role as wife or mom, because those roles aren't always there. Do you guys have any examples of how this affects guys?
Sure. So I think we may not have, not all of us have the same kind of nurturing tendencies to the degree that women has as a generality, but like to give counsel and advice and to be able to have your kids respond to that and say, that's helpful. You know, that's where I think like, and that's what we want to see, and we feel respected. And so it's easy just to keep, you know, to jump into that and to recognize that, not recognize the shifts where people take more responsibility for themselves. Not to say that you don't give counsel, but it's very different when a 6-year-old versus a 16-year-old or 26-year-old. So I think just being willing to let kids kind of find their way, you know, while you teach them principles is a challenge. So it's easy. I think too, another aspect of this is like where you see what will help your kids do well, and you may very well be right. And so you tell them all the things they should do, you know, and you keep telling them, and you're on them about it and so on, but you don't really give them that space to figure those things out and implement the principles in their own specific circumstance. And that can produce some tension in the relationship. Also keep them from being able to grow in the way that they need to.
So my question is a little more geared toward, like, it seemed like Pete really struggled with overfunctioning when it came to his work. Does that tend to be an issue for guys, like as far as overfunctioning goes?
I'd have to think about that one. I think that could definitely happen, where you don't allow people to. So there's a distinction there between holding people accountable and then trying to do things for them. You know, giving too much advice, you know, being involved, you know, not letting them work through it. And, you know, you come in every time and you're like, no, this is the way to do it. If you hear a complaint from someone, you get involved. You know, it's like you're a manager at a factory and you hear a customer complaints, you go in, you try to sort it all out rather than bring it to the person in charge. So I think absolutely that any high functioning person is probably going to have that tendency to want to solve more than they should.
I agree with that, but I think for me personally, in some ways, mine was the opposite. I had an easier time at work encouraging people to do things on their own, stepping back, letting them learn for themselves, watching them fail, even not maybe not in a bad way, but you know, but letting them struggle. But then at home, I would step in, and still do a lot, step in and, you know, just do it myself, or just rather than here, why don't you learn, like with my kids, like just like giving them this like strict instructions on you have to do it this way and things like that. So with me, it kind of almost became the opposite. Although I did overfunction at work at times too, but I found the struggle, because she talks about, and Wes pointed it out, the chaos at home, and he pointed it out with this toaster story. I love that one, of letting the kid cry and letting her struggle. At work, I could step back and watch that struggle, but at home, I didn't want to hear that struggle. Cool. Maybe because it's different, maybe because it's more personal, maybe because it's your kids. I don't know.
The family is always more emotionally intense. And so that kind of, the family probably tells you more of who you really are than work will. I've read countless stories of people who were able to function so well at work, but then their family life was an absolute mess. I read the story of James Madison, one of our presidents. He accomplished so much as a president, but then his family life, he just, because of the type of relationship he had with his kids, ended up sinking him financially and so on, even though he did really well in his business and so on. Mm-hmm. So I'd say that is common. How we react to our family is probably one of the best gauges of where we are emotionally. And so conversely, if we can learn to relate better in our families, in those most intense relationships, it'll probably have effects everywhere else.
So Lacey, sometimes I've noticed that with you, when you ask this, do one of you have a story? You have a hidden story in there that you want to share. So what's yours?
So my story kind of relates to her breaking free. So just real quick, the last consequence is overfunctioning can destroy community. And she quotes Ed Friedman, who says, when one overfunctions in another's space, it can cause disintegration of another's being. Healthy community really requires that individuals take responsibility for that are as appropriate for their age, life stages, and gifts and abilities. And so when she says that she actually broke free from this, she gives you four steps for it, which is admit you're overfunctioning, unleash the earthquake, prepare for chaos, and stand firm. And mine, it kind of fits that, my example. So I get to go spend this weekend with some of my friends from Pennsylvania. We moved from Pennsylvania 2 years ago and have some really good friends that live there. And so I get to go spend this weekend with them. And in order to do that, my husband is facilitating a weekend trip for my boys to the beach. It's one of those things where I kind of freaked, because I'm like, wait, if I'm not there, like, how are you going to keep them safe? How are you going to always have your eyes on them? How are you always going to make sure all three of them are like respecting boundaries? And so I feel really lucky because my husband does not take that opportunity to underfunction. He's like, the world is not going to fall apart if you're not there. Like, I know how to watch our kids. I know, you know, and he probably does them way more of a favor than I would, because he gives them the chance to take calculated risks where he is still watching and keeping them safe and allowing them to make those mistakes and still be safe. And so it's just interesting to me whenever I start to feel like it's how I know I am an overfunctioner and that I need to work on it is this is me admitting to you guys that I am an overfunctioner. That's the first step, right? when I ask my, whenever I start to feel like I am indispensable and it's not going to be, nothing is going to go well if I'm not there. And so it's definitely something that I'm working on in my life, but I'm very lucky in that I don't feel like I have to unleash the earthquake, which is when you kind of make the announcement, hey, things are going to change. And I don't have to deal with the chaos necessarily, maybe sometimes, of that change rocking everybody's world. And then standing firm, I feel really lucky that Ben is like, hey, I'm not going to allow you to overfunction for me in this area. So that's my example of being an overfunctioner.
Well, and remember in the story that when Peter did start taking over a couple nights of the week and he'd cook and take everybody and it'd be kind of his nights, then they actually liked Peter's nights more than Jerry's. And then that was a whole new thing to deal with.
It did take a while for that to get there, though. Yes. I think there were some like forgotten children.
Oh, yeah. That's yes. Right.
For
true.
Dinners. So that's kind of the unleash the earthquake and prepare for chaos. But then you continue standing firm and you allow things to right themselves. And that will take some work and some time.
Sure. Well, guys, We've overfunctioned this podcast. We've done a great job. No, it's been a pleasure talking with you all today. So obviously I think we would all recommend the book, The Emotionally Healthy Woman, for men and women to read. Also, guess I would recommend reading Exodus 18, learning about Moses and Jethro. And what happened there. And if you want to read about Mary and Martha, read the Gospels, read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Those are good. Those are my recommendations for people to do.
And like we'll put the links to the chapter, the audio version of the chapter in the notes under the podcast. So you can check that out.
Awesome.
Definitely. Okay.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Everybody have a good day. God bless you.
Bye-bye.